Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, bishops of England and Wales meet to discuss some pressing moral issues, as well as the drawing up of two new documents on interfaith dialogue and ministry to migrants. American bishops also begin a meeting in Baltimore with a new document on faith and politics ahead of next year's presidential election at the top of the agenda. But first, Pope Benedict makes an urgent appeal for Lebanon's rival leaders to lay personal interest aside and work for the good of the Middle Eastern nation. Welcome to the programme. Pope Benedict on Sunday urged Lebanon's rival leaders to unite behind a common presidential candidate who can represent all people in the divided country. On Saturday, Lebanon's parliament postponed for 10 days a presidential election set for November the 12th. The move was aimed at breaking a deadlock over a consensus candidate and ending a political crisis that is threatening the stability of the country. The Pope's words came as he greeted thousands of pilgrims and visitors gathered for the recitation of the Angelus prayer, during which he also remembered the 4th century saint Martin of Tours, whose feast day falls on November the 11th. My colleague Emma McCarthy takes a closer look at what Pope Benedict had to say.
Cari fratelli e sorelle, l'Assemblea Nazionale Libanese sarà prossimamente chiamata ad eleggere il nuovo capo dello Stato.
In comments in Italian to the thousands of pilgrims gathered beneath a winter sky this Sunday, Pope Benedict said, as the numerous initiatives of these days show, the pending elections for a new head of state in Lebanon is a crucial passage upon which depends the very survival of Lebanon and its institutions. The Pope continued that he shared the Maronite Patriarch Cardinal Nasrallah's fierce concerns recently expressed regarding the divisions among the nation's political leaders, as well as his desire that all Lebanese can see themselves represented in the new president. The Holy Father said he prayed that all interested parties take the necessary distance from personal interests and have true passion for common good.
E una vera passione per il bene comune.
The Pope's appeal comes in the wake of the latest delay in the crucial parliamentary vote. Saturday evening, the vote was postponed for the third time, now to November 21st, 3 days before the current president, Emile Lahoud's mandate expires. A September session failed to reach quorum because of an opposition boycott. An October attempt was postponed as negotiators struggled to find a compromised candidate. But tensions between pro-Syrian parties and the government and divisions among Christian deputies have failed to bring consensus on a candidate who, according to the constitution, must be Maronite Christian.
Angelus Domini nunciavit Maria.
Before reciting the Angelus prayer, the Holy Father had also urged the world to greater solidarity, once again by holding up the example of a saint, 4th century Martin of Tours.
At this time, the Church remembers St. Martin of Tours, the saintly monk and bishop who was moved with such great compassion for the sufferings of the poor, recalling the occasion when he cut his cloak in two and gave one half to a poor man, we resolve to follow his example by sharing what we have with those less fortunate than ourselves.
Saint Martin, concluded the Pope, helps us to understand that only through a common commitment to sharing can we answer the great challenges of our time. That is, to build a world of justice and peace where every human being can live in dignity. This, he said, can only happen if a global model of authentic solidarity prevails, capable of ensuring that all of the world's people have access to food, water and healthcare, but also to work and recourse to energy as well as culture and scientific and technological knowledge.
Upon all of you and upon your families and loved ones at home, I invoke God's abundance blessings. Arrivederci, buona domenica.
And my thanks to Emma McCarthy for that report on Pope Benedict's Angelus address. Returning to that political crisis in Lebanon, Professor Khalil Karam of St. Joseph's University in Beirut is former Secretary General of the Maronite League. He explains why the elections were postponed on Monday and why the Patriarch is playing a key role in seeking a broad political consensus.
Now, Lebanon is a country of consensus, and no consensus was ready to be done this morning because it was supposed to be today, the election. And things are complicated by a lot of regional interferences, and the French have begun a very serious initiative in order to bring together all the involved parties in this election. The Minister of Foreign Affairs of France, Dr. Bernard Kouchner, should be coming between tonight and tomorrow in order to continue the discussions, and this will take some time. So we were expecting the elections to be postponed till the 19th, but the Speaker of the House, he took two more days. He made it on the 21st in order to gain a little bit more time. The deadline is the 23rd of November, because the President of the Republic should be leaving office on the 24th of November. So we are really there is a shortage of time, and we are still a bit optimistic that the French will arrive a comprehensive solution. Now, concerning the appeal of the Pope, it's the first news in all our satellites, our TVs and newspapers. And it is considered as a very strong support to the Patriarch, who is playing a central role in this election. Normally, in a democratic country, it should not. He is a spiritual leader, and that's all. But it happens because there is very serious fracture in the political on the political scene. So the spiritual leadership needs to interfere, because otherwise the country is in a very serious and critical danger. It's not his will, it's because the situation imposed on him this position.
Lebanese Professor Khalil Karam of St. Joseph's University in Beirut. Bishops from across England and Wales are gathered in the northern city of Leeds this week for a meeting which will tackle some pressing moral issues facing Catholics in today's secular society. These include reactions to Amnesty International's recent decision to support a woman's right to abortion in certain situations, as well as responding to new government legislation which will oblige Catholic adoption agencies to consider homosexual couples as prospective parents. Italian Archbishop Bruno Forte will be addressing the bishops' gathering on contemporary questions of religious freedom. And the bishops will also be discussing a new government report on child protection policy. Finally, the church leaders will be laying foundations for two documents on interfaith dialogue and ministry to migrants, two increasingly important issues in today's multi-ethnic and multi-faith context. Monsignor Andrew Summersgill is General Secretary of the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. He starts off by taking a closer look at the new government anti-discrimination legislation, which the Church is expected to comply with by the end of 2008.
The discussions with the government come about because the sexual orientation regulations are about discrimination in the provision of goods and services. And these regulations, as they've been drafted in this country, refer to adoption as a good or a service. And there are several Catholic agencies who prepare people as parents for children who are presented for adoption through the local authorities. And the problem that is faced by the Church in this country is that if the agencies are to continue in providing statutory adoption services, then they are going to have to consider having what is called an open policy, which means accepting as prospective adoptive parents couples who are in same-sex relationships. And that's a problem for the church, because the church cannot be in the position of validating same-sex relationships as being on an equal status as marriage and providing the basis for family life.
So is this likely to mean the closure then of these Catholic adoption agencies, or is there some way that there can be an agreement with the government to allow the agencies to carry on in some other way?
Well, we would sincerely hope the latter. We would sincerely hope that there is a way in which the adoption agencies can continue to be part of the statutory provision, because the reputation of the Catholic agencies is second to none, and the Catholic agencies provide a particularly good service in the placement of what they call difficult-to-place children and the follow-up that is followed, because what you have is that the Catholic agencies are very good at maintaining contact and support with the families that come about through placements through them. So what we are trying to do is to work with both the agencies and with the governments during this period, which you mentioned, through to the end of 2008, to find a solution, something that allows the church to be doing this work because it's work for the common good, that doesn't compromise the principles and the teachings of the church and provides a valuable service which is appreciated by everybody.
Another issue regarding questions of Catholic principles is the recent decision by Amnesty International to support a woman's right to abortion in certain situations, such as rape, for example. And I understand there are perhaps some quite differing viewpoints among the bishops as to how best to react to this decision.
No, I don't think there are differing viewpoints at all. I think the situation as it stands at the moment is, well, the bishops have been quite clear, particularly through Bishop Michael Evans, as to the way in which they didn't want Amnesty to adopt the position that it has done. What has now happened is that things have moved on to a different level, and what you find in this country, as I think probably in many other countries, is that there are particularly Amnesty youth groups and Amnesty school groups, because the schools and youth groups find the infrastructure provided by Amnesty as a very helpful and in many ways the only way in which they can engage in the wider work of Amnesty, such as being in touch with prisoners of conscience and that kind of thing. And Amnesty have obviously sense that this is a difficult area for them, because they're not wanting to lose the support of Catholic schools and Catholic youth groups. And so they took the initiative of writing to Catholic schools to explain their position. Now, in explaining that position and making explicit the changes that have come about in Amnesty, that now puts the schools in a very difficult position, because while they want to do the work and they want to share in the work, they cannot share in the principles that Amnesty is now adopting. And so what the bishops will have to consider is how best they advise schools to continue with what is a very important and a very vital work, and it's one which the schools and the youth groups are particularly engaged in.
You'll also be looking, won't you, at the response to the so-called Cumberledge report regarding child protection policies for the Catholic Church. Again, can you give us an idea of what kind of response, what kind of form this response might take?
Yeah, well, the Cumberledge report came out in July. It's the fruit of about just under a year's work by an independent commission to review the policies and the processes and the work, considerable amount of work, that's gone on in the church in this country in the last 5 or 6 years to put in place child protection policies. And the commission has come out with a very basic recommendation, which is that we are now at the stage in this country, in common with a lot of civil society, where we need to broaden our understanding of what we're doing, and that we make the move from child protection to the whole world of what is called safeguarding, so that within that you have child protection, but it's much wider, so it includes the care of vulnerable adults, and it is the whole raising of awareness of the vulnerability of people and how, as a community, we respond to that. So the basic recommendation that comes out is, well, we must make sure that our minds and hearts are very much focused on safeguarding, and that we have the infrastructure in parishes, dioceses, and at the national level, which enables what really is an essential part of the church's ministry to be accomplished. At the same time, of course, then there are also the civil and the canonical requirements that go with that. And what we therefore have to do is to make sure that the policies, the processes, the structure and the infrastructure are compliant both with the requirements of the law in this country and also with the canonical requirements that there are for people who are working in the name of the church, and particularly for the clergy. And what I think will be coming forward from the bishops' meeting will be certainly an acceptance of that principle. It's a very good principle indeed, and it builds perfectly on the child protection principle and the paramountcy of the vulnerable. And then looking at the ways in which the structures we presently have in place can be adapted to meet that. It's not going to be an immediate change because, as you can imagine, some of this can be quite complicated. And we're also dealing with a changing legislative environment as well. And just working the two together is going to take a few months to put in place.
Looking at some of the other issues on the agenda for this meeting, I understand there are a couple of documents, a couple of papers in preparation, particularly looking ahead to a document on interreligious dialogue. Now, this is an issue of growing importance, obviously, for the church. I presume in the British context, you're talking particularly about dialogue with Muslims and Hindus.
Yeah, but not exclusively. That certainly is a major part of it, because of the context in which we find ourselves in this country, and there is a growing number of Muslims in this country. But also, I don't think to be underestimated in our context is also dialogue with Judaism. I know that it's a very different kind of dialogue, but interreligious dialogue in our context is, I suppose, it's largely focused around the three monotheistic faiths. So it's focused around Christianity, Judaism and Islam. And then there are the other faiths alongside that. And what the document is trying to tease out is what the purpose of that dialogue is and what the different stages and methods of dialogue there might be. I'd say that within our context, there is almost a natural inclination, certainly among the leadership of the churches and the leadership of the faiths, to seek to be working together to provide a witness in an increasingly secularizing society of the importance of faith, and faith as a means towards providing some sort of cohesiveness within society, which, you know, many people would find to be lacking. So the bishops will be looking at this document with a view to having a far more formal look at it next year, and then looking at how the principles within it can be taught within the Catholic community.
There's also, if I understand correctly, a document in preparation about the Church's mission to migrants, the whole outreach to the many, many thousands of people who are coming over to the UK to seek work, to seek a better life.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, if you look at the way in which the Church in our country, at its history, it is a history of welcoming migrants. The Catholic Church has continuously gone through change and development as different groups of migrants have come to this country. And it has been particularly enhanced in the last few years with the enlargement of the European Union and migrants coming from different parts of the European Union. And perhaps, quite noticeably, recently, that migration has largely been Catholic, and therefore is injecting different types of interesting life into the church. And there are all sorts of opportunities for us. And as a kind of welcoming community, then we really need to work out how best we can welcome the gifts that are being brought to us, as well as sharing our own gifts with those who are coming to us. So what we're trying to do is to pull together a reflection which shows what the principles of the gospel and of the life and the history of the church are, and how then that practically is put into effect in the church as it seems to be developing in this country now.
Sounds as though the bishops have got plenty on their plates throughout the coming week. So for the moment, thank you for sharing some of that with us.
Okay, my pleasure.
My thanks there to Monsignor Andrew Summersgill, General Secretary of the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. Across the other side of the Atlantic, the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops is also holding its regular November meeting in Baltimore, with voting on an updated document about faith and politics, one of the key items on the agenda. Every 4 years, in tandem with the US presidential election cycle, the bishops publish this document to offer guidelines on the formation of consciences in political life. But the document is just one of the items on a packed agenda that the bishops will consider during their 4-day meeting beginning on Monday. Among the participants at the Baltimore Assembly is Bishop Thomas Wenske, chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee. He talked to my colleague Susie Hodges about the importance of this meeting.
Well, this meeting has got a very significant agenda because of the vote of the entire body of bishops on the faithful citizenship document that we hope will help form the consciences of Catholics as we move into our election year.
I gather that this year, though, there is a slight divergence in the norm in that all the bishops will be voting on this document. Why was that decision taken?
In the past, the document was voted by the administrative committee of the conference, which is about 30-35 bishops, but it was thought that the document itself would carry more weight if it came as a document of the entire body of bishops. And in the last election cycle, we had some competing documents out there that represented views either from the left or the right that purported to be Catholic teaching documents. They were not, but they were written by well-intentioned, would hope, lay people and some other people. But they also had a kind of a partisan flavor to them. What we want to do in this document is to speak as teachers, as shepherds of our people, and as I said, to help form consciences. And it is a very difficult situation because no one party and most candidates do not fully conform to the Catholic vision of the common good in most areas. So it is a very serious responsibility for Catholics to approach the voting booth with a sense of the responsibility that they have, but to do so with a desire to be coherent with their beliefs as Catholics.
But do you think it'll be easy then for the bishops to reach a consensus on this document, or do you think there'll be some quite keen discussion?
Well, I think there will be keen discussions, and there have been already, and the consultations have been rather far-reaching. In the past, most of the document had been prepared by the Committee for International Policy and the Committee for Domestic Policy, which deals with issues of war and peace, welfare, immigration, the general public policy questions. In preparing this edition of Faithful Citizenship and the Formation of Conscience, for our Catholic people, the consultation was a bit wider, in which we got input from the Pro-Life Committee, the Doctrine Committee, and other public policy committees, so that we would try to perhaps reach or help build a consensus before we got to the debate on the floor. I think we have a very good document right now. It'll be tweaked further as we discuss it on the floor of the bishops' meeting, but I do think that the document will be supported by the bishops, and because it does teach clearly, it does teach coherently, and it is certainly within the sense of the moral teachings of the Church that we find in the Catechism and in the documents of the Vatican Council and in the magisterium of the popes of the recent decades.
Another key item at this meeting will be when you receive a preliminary report on the causes and context of the clergy sexual abuse crisis. What are likely to be the main findings of this? Do you know? And when will the final report be ready?
Well, I don't know when the final report will be ready, and I don't want to speculate on what the findings will be. However, it does seem, from what I've heard and read so far, that one of the things that will be, I think, supported is the fact that this crisis was an episode, a very sad episode, that had a beginning and an end. Most of the cases of abuse that have been reported in the United States began to appear in the late 60s and subsided by the early 80s. And by the late 80s, most bishops throughout the United States had taken measures to prevent such abuses in the future. Not all dioceses took the measures in the same way, and some were certainly remiss, and that's part of the reason that we suffered the fallout from the scandal. However, I think that this findings will show that it did have a beginning and it does have an end, and hopefully the measures put in place and the renewal of seminary life and the renewal of the church will put this very sad chapter in the history of the American church behind us. Again, I think the words of the Holy Father and during the height of the crisis, John Paul II at that time, were very important. That what we want to see coming out of this crisis is a holier church, a holier priesthood, and a holier episcopacy.
Another item on the agenda at this meeting is a vote on the revision of music guidelines at Mass. Why was it felt necessary to revise these guidelines, and what are likely to be the main changes or innovations?
Well, again, we're at the beginning of having a major renovation or retranslation of the Roman Missal, and that will hopefully be approved within the next year or two, and therefore it makes sense to review the regulations or the guidelines for the use of music in the liturgy so that the new Missal will also embody a renewal of liturgical music. Again, it's no secret that in the immediate aftermath of the council, there was a lot of innovation, and some of it was very poorly thought out, and oftentimes some secular music and music that was a bit bland and trite got into the liturgy and detracted from the sacredness of the liturgical experience of the sacred mysteries. And so, again, this is, I would say, part of the reform of the reform that has been called for.
Bishop Thomas Wenske, chair of the U.S. Bishops Foreign Affairs Committee, talking to my colleague Susie Hodges. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. Thank you for joining us, and remember to tune in again at this same time tomorrow if you can. If not, don't forget you can always find us on the internet. For updates on all our news and feature programmes, just go to www.vaticanradio.org/English. For now, stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.